Hello, time travelers, and welcome to Biblical Time Machine. Before we get into today's episode, we wanted to announce the winners of our latest giveaways. So, Helen, this is a big one. We have only one winner who gets a free pass to the SBL Virtual Global Meeting, and that person is Gareth Thomas. So congratulations, Gareth. Gareth is one of our subscribers through Apple Podcasts. I wanted to remind you guys, if you are another one of the people who signed up through Apple Podcasts, we do not have your contact information. So please email us and say, hey, I subscribe through Apple. Here's my name. Here's my email. So we can get you into giveaways like this one. And now, Helen, we have our 10th and final winner of the SBL Study Bible. Who is it?
Yeah, it's the last one that we're giving away. But I'm sure there'll be plenty more books in due course. And this is going to Alison Dillon. So well done, Alison.
Okay, well, that's it for our giveaways for now. Let's get to our episode about crucifixion. We actually recorded this a bunch of months ago, but we held onto it for the Easter season. So let's get to that now. Hello, and welcome back to Biblical Time Machine, your favorite Bible history podcast. I am one of your hosts, Dave Roos. I am here with Helen Bond, professor of Christian origins at the University of Edinburgh. We are doing one of our Easter episodes, and today, Helen, we got to talk about it. I don't know how we haven't talked about this up to this point, but we've danced around.
I know.
We're going to do crucifixion. How do you feel about this?
I think it's just because it's so gruesome. I mean, I think we'll find out that the Romans felt pretty much the same as us, that, you know, better left saying nothing about crucifixion. It's just, you know, the ultimate penalty, and then you move on quickly. It's going to be a bit gloomy the next
week. Yeah, no, a warning to our listeners. Obviously, yeah. This is kind of a dark subject. There are some graphic descriptions that you kind of can't get around when you're talking about a capital punishment like this. So if it's not your cup of tea, you know, we'll see you at the next episode.
Skip it.
But if you
you have our official permission.
Yeah, you
to
have
skip.
Our permission. You've already clicked on this, so we already get the download. So we're already getting rich off of this. But anyway, but if you've been, you know, morbidly curious about this, and I think all of us have, we've just sort of wondered how. You know, how did it actually work? How many people were crucified in the Roman world? Was it rare? Was it common? Was it public? Was it private? You know, all these questions. And we have
even women.
And women, yeah, women would get it too. They're not spared this one. We have a great guest to talk about this with us. So John Granger Cook, he is a professor of religion at LaGrange College. I don't think there's any relation between Granger and LaGrange.
They named it after him.
Named after him in Georgia. And he wrote a book called Crucifixion in the Mediterranean World. And, you know, particularly talking about the Roman Empire and how this punishment was used. And I want to direct our listeners as well to Bible Odyssey. So our partners at Bible Odyssey have some cool entries about crucifixion in art and crucifixion and sort of the idea of shame in the ancient world and in the New Testament. They have a good entry on this, the cross in general, where you can read a little bit about some of the topics that we're talking about today, like what did this word stauros in Greek really mean? Was it a pole? Was it a cross? Those kind of questions. So, you know, without further ado, let's get to our conversation with John Granger Cook about crucifixion. Well, John Granger Cook, welcome to Biblical Time Machine.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
All right. Well, Helen and I were just talking about how, you know, crucifixion is kind of a gruesome topic, but it is also kind of fascinating. So, John, what do we know about the origins of crucifixion? Was this something that the Romans came up with all by themselves, or were people doing this before them?
there were analogies in the ancient world. The Assyrians and the Babylonians practiced impalement, and the Greeks practiced something called exposition, where they would tie a person to a wheel or something like that. Mm. And there has been some archaeological discoveries in Greece where skeleton was sort of attached to wood with a staple, several of those discoveries. And then Carthage possibly practiced crucifixion.
So
something like crucifixion.
So they picked it up from them when they were, because they had a big fight against the Carthaginians, didn't they? So is the idea that they, yes, they got the idea from their enemies there?
It's possible. It's not really clear. The Romans may have attributed crucifixion to Carthage. And the particular author I'm thinking of is named Livy. Mm-hmm. And Livy may have taken Roman crucifixion and sort of transferred it to Carthage, because he lived much later than those wars, the Punic Wars. But during the Second Punic War, which is around 218 to 211 BCE, that is around, that's the time when the first historical crucifixions emerge in Rome.
Okay. And you said the Assyrians and other people practice impalement. Impalement, I don't even know if I want to get into this. But
I was wondering that too, whether I dared to ask. It sounds really painful.
I mean, John, what is your like least disgusting description of impalement?
None of them are not disgusting, but in the British Museum, there's a set of bronze doors called the Balawat doors. And there are depictions of individuals who are impaled through the soft tissue between their legs vertically. And so, you know, that gives you some idea of how horrific that kind of death was. And there's others who are impaled from the back of their lungs, sort of pleural cavity to the front. So, I mean, it's just a horrific death. Yeah. And I think normally the Assyrians didn't do things like that unless a city refused to surrender.
Mm. I mean, they would be very, very quick deaths though, wouldn't they? I mean, if you've got a pole going, right? I mean, the big thing with the crucifixion is that it's a really slow death as well, isn't it? So yes, there might be bits of wood involved, but the sort of the concept is quite different, isn't it?
I don't think the Romans practiced impalement very much, but that's sort of a point of contention with some of my colleagues.
Well, so, all right, give us an idea, because, you know, in the New Testament, we have this one example. Well, I guess we have a couple of examples. Obviously, Jesus is punished through crucifixion, but we see that he is crucified along with some other criminals. Do we have a sense, you know, from the Roman records and literature, even how frequently this type of punishment was meted out?
Well, one of the chapters in my book is on historical crucifixions in Rome from the Second Punic War to Constantine, who I think abolished the practice. Mm. I mean, there's pretty good evidence that Constantine at least began to abolish it. I'm sure it happened here and there after, but for instance, there was a war against Pompey, Sextus Pompeius. Now, this is not Pompey the Great. This is another Pompey, Sextus Pompeius. And Augustus, in his last will and testament, says he sent 30,000 slaves back to their masters for punishment. And the normal slave punishment was crucifixion.
30,000.
So you can imagine that, you know, maybe depending on how valuable the slave was, but that could be almost 30,000 crucified, after one revolt.
And so what, I guess, you know, what type of crime? So this was a revolt. Were there kind of more, I don't know, do we know from Roman law kind of what crimes were punishable by death and then particularly by crucifixion?
Well, there were all kinds of crimes, and I want to give a short answer here, but for instance, arson, you had the Neronian crucifixion of some of the Christians for arson, magic, counterfeiting, especially a coin with the emperor's image on it, kidnapping, sedition, and the, for instance, the bandits that were crucified with Jesus were almost certainly crucified for sedition. Bandit is a better translation than thief, I think. And you get that in with pirates. Pirates are bandits, and piracy, those pirates were subject to crucifixion. Desertion from the army, that was, and then a slave that was disobedient. A slave could be crucified without trial. So,
and crucifixion,
probably enough.
The crucifixion is very much known as sort of the slave's death, isn't it? And is it?
That's right.
Is it? I mean, am I right in thinking that it's really people of low status? Because I don't think Roman citizens could be crucified, could they? Is that right? Or maybe we have a few examples of it happening.
With slaves, it was called the servile supplicium, the servile punishment, crucifixion. So when one reads those words, one thinks of crucifixion. As far as citizens go, it's interesting. In those that chapter on historical crucifixions, I looked for the number of names, and I could only find 18 names of crucified people, of whom Jesus is one. And one of the more questionable ones is a citizen who was allegedly crucified for divulging the secret name of Rome. So, you know, that whole discussion in itself is questionable, but there was a really bad governor of Sicily named Verres who crucified a Roman citizen, and Cicero was very upset with that, and he basically chased Verres out of power with one of his orations, which I don't think was ever delivered. But and then there was another citizen who apparently seduced the emperor Claudius's wife. So
that'll do it.
He allegedly was crucified, but in general, upper class citizens were not crucified. Lower class, I think, may be different. And normally foreigners.
Oh yeah.
Foreigners and slaves.
Do what you like with foreigners, can't you? And what about women? Is there ever any evidence of women being crucified? Because you're naked as well, aren't you? I mean, yeah. I'm just sort of thinking this element of shame in the whole thing. I mean, that would be pretty horrific.
Yeah. That word naked is something that colleague Felicity Harley McGowan has pointed out could include a loincloth. So,
oh, right. Okay.
But as far as that word gumnos in Greek, which G-U-M-N-O-S, could include a loincloth, but in any case, it was humiliating. There's a famous story where a Roman knight wanted to sleep with a Roman matron, and she wouldn't sleep with him. So a freed woman named Ida, got some Egyptian priests to collude and convince the Roman matron, the woman, the high class woman, that Apollo wanted to sleep with her in the temple. And so the knight got off with maybe exile or something like that. But they crucified Ida and they crucified the Egyptian priests. And then you have Alcamilla, who the most ancient depiction of graffito of crucifixion, and that may be a historical crucifixion.
Well, yeah, tell us about this graffiti. So where was this found? Kind of what time period would that have been from?
It was found in the late 50s in Puteoli. It's still on private land, so it's not visible to tourists. Tourists can't visit it. And maybe that's a good thing, actually. but it is one of several what they call taberni, which are like inns, a taberna, like where we get
tavern.
From which we get our word tavern. And inside are all kinds of graffiti, and one of them is a small cross, and above that cross with a different, and it was done by a different hand than the hand that carved into the plaster, the the cross itself. Mm. In a different hand is the Greek name Alcamilla, a woman's name. Mm-hmm. And you should ask me about the Lex Pudiolana a little bit later.
We will.
But there are women mentioned in that too.
And so that graffito, they date that to kind of what era, what time period?
Trajan's and Hadrian's.
Well, that means so nothing.
Somewhere early, in that era.
Early second century.
Late first century, early second century.
Mm-hmm. Of the common era.
So it's the oldest.
Yeah, that is really, yeah. So that's earlier than the Alexamenos one, which people might have heard of. Do you want to tell us a bit about the Alexamenos too?
Yes, that one is third century, and it's a graffito of a man with a donkey's head, which is almost certainly but Alexamenos, the Italians call it the blasphemous graffito, and I think that's accurate. It is a depiction of Jesus, because underneath is the caption, Alexamenos worships his God. And he's holding his hand out in sort of a sign of respect or something like that, a prayer. And I don't think it's a Gnostic deity or anything like that. I think it's just simply it's an understanding of Christianity, and it's a pretty good one.
I find it fascinating that we're looking at, you know, graffiti from the ancient world, and I know that there's been a lot of study of graffiti, but man, I hope that in the future they're not depending on like our graffiti to figure out what our culture was all about. It's going to be a very sad conclusions that they're going to come to.
The Romans were not anxious to depict crucifixion.
Mm.
Those are the only two graffiti that have been found so far of crucified individuals. Hmm. Now, there are some gems which depict Christ's crucifixion, but only one of those gems, and they are tiny, tiny gems, the size of a ring. And they come, only one comes from the Roman era, and several of them are found in the British Museum, as a matter of fact.
And what about... what about other forms of execution? I mean, presumably the Romans can crucify you if you're a slave or a sort of a lower class person. But what other options did Romans have in terms of getting rid of people, particularly sort of higher class people, I suppose?
Well, they had I don't think they would have used these for the so-called upper classes, but they have a set of punishments called the summa supplicia, mm-hmm. the highest penalties. For instance, throwing you to wild animals.
Oh, in the arena.
In the arena. There's a very famous inscription, famous to me, in Pompeii, which says there's going to be gladiatorial battles in Cumae, in the amphitheater, and they are going to be several people crucified, and there's going to be beast fights. But being thrown to the beasts, to the wild beasts, was one of the worst forms of death too. And then burning. They would burn people at the stake. And there were several other forms of execution like that.
None of all right.
Well,
good.
Yeah, you have to. I don't know where crucifixion falls in these terrible options.
all equally bad, I think.
Equally bad. Well, one of our listeners, I should say, you know, inspired this episode a little bit because he asked a question about this Greek word staros. Is that, am I pronouncing that right? Staros and.
Staros.
Okay, so he...
Close enough.
And he wanted to keep his name anonymous, so let's call him... Josephus. Let's call him Josephus. Josephus emailed and asked about this Greek word, and I guess, I don't know if there's actual controversy or if there's just some scholarly debate about whether or not that word refers to a cross, or if it just refers to like a pole. Is there a chance that we kind of get it wrong when we think of a crucifixion on a cross? Or are there other words? You know, is there a word crux or I mean, isn't there like a Latin word that means cross? Anyway, help us figure out, you know, these ancient words for cross that are used, and what do we think they mean?
Well, let's start with the Latin words, first of all, because that's the most technical vocabulary of the Romans. Sure. The patibulum is, generally speaking, the horizontal piece. But there was an extended use where the patibulum could be the horizontal and the vertical. And the context makes that very clear. For instance, in some texts, it will say that a person carried the patibulum to the crux. And in that case, the crux, the crux, is the vertical. Hmm. Now, at sometimes the crux can mean just vertical, or it can mean a vertical combined with horizontal. And again, you watch for context here. Now, staros in itself could mean pole, but in terms of the New Testament, and in some other Greek texts, it will say the criminal carried a staros. And in that case, you have an example of whole used for part. That's what it's called. So instead of being just the horizontal and vertical, that means it's just that Jesus carried the horizontal piece. And we know from that his cross had a horizontal piece, because from the Latin texts in Rome, we know that nobody ever carried the horizontal attached to the vertical. Hmm. Okay. Now, that's a complicated answer.
Well, yeah. So let's clear this up. So, all right. So obviously we use the English word cross, and we look at a word like crux, and we're like, oh, that means cross. That means something that's in a cross shape. But you're saying crux could have just meant the vertical part, like the straight up and down pole.
Yes.
Oh, okay. And same with staros, that it could have been either the straight up and down pole, or it could have been the horizontal piece, but it sounds like they were two separate things.
Yes, since we know that Jesus and Simon, well, according to the Gospels, that is, since Jesus and Simon of Cyrene both carried what the Greek word carried what in Greek is the staros, mm-hmm. We know they carried the patibulum.
The horizontal piece.
They carried the patibulum. They carried the cross, the horizontal piece, to the vertical. Now, whether the vertical was already set in the ground or whether it was lying on the ground is unclear. All right. Those are the sorts of things that are sort of lost in history. One can speculate, but one can't answer.
And presumably it would have varied in different places, would it? Do you think there was a standard mm-hmm. way of doing it? Or do you think, you know, different commanders kind of, and different local availability of stuff and things like that? Do you think there were local variations?
I think certainly there were local variations. And, you know, for instance, in the battle, the siege of Jerusalem, Titus, who was besieging it as general for his father Vespasian, was crucifying as many as 500 deserters a day. I mean, people mm-hmm. leaving Jerusalem, that is, deserting the zealots. Mm. And Josephus says that some of the soldiers, of course, they were angry because the people wouldn't surrender. And so they crucified them in different poses. Mm. And we know from some texts that upside down was an option. Mm. And I don't just mean later sort of legendary accounts of Peter's crucifixion upside down. I mean, maybe he was crucified upside down, but there are historical texts that describe people being crucified upside down. And so there, various poses. Mm.
All right. Well, I have to get into the nitty gritty of this, and I apologize to listeners if it gets a little gruesome, but I want to talk about, you know, how accurate do we think historically is the account in the New Testament of Jesus's, you know, of his crucifixion, of his last kind of hours. So, for example, you know, you said there is one inaccuracy, at least in the way that is portrayed in art sometimes and in movies, where he would have been carrying the entire cross. So now we're saying probably carrying just the horizontal piece. But would a condemned person also be sort of beaten and tortured as they were going to the place of the crucifixion?
The Roman texts describe various tortures used, and I mean, including burning and all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. A torture shirt that was made of papyrus and pitch and wax and things like that. Mm-hmm. But one of the tortures that was used very frequently was flagellation, which is being beaten with a leather whip. Mm-hmm. And there's a very famous photograph in the Library of Congress of a slave, American slave in the 19th century, who had been beaten brutally with a whip, and he has welts that have healed all over his back. And so, taking it back 1900 years to Josephus, he tells a story where a man was whipped so brutally, a Jewish man, by one of the Roman governors, that his bones and his back began to show. He was prophesying the fall of the temple and wouldn't be quiet. So they quiet him down. But yeah, the flagellation was a very brutal torture. And I have very mixed feelings about Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. But the scene of flagellation in that film was probably fairly accurate, I would think. That it was just, or even maybe not as brutal as the Romans could make it. I mean, sometimes they could put bits of bone in those whips, and just imagine being whipped with leather attached to bone, and it's just unimaginable the damage that would do to a human body. But then torture with metal plates and flames and other things could be used. And it's, you know, the Romans were, I mean, they have amazing administrative abilities, but there was also sort of a dark underbelly to the Roman Empire. Yeah. This is it.
Yeah, definitely. And what about, you know, we sort of think, because Jesus had nails through his, well, you know, the picture in art is that he's got nails through his hands, which I understand from people who know these things wouldn't have worked. It would have to be more like your wrists. But is nailing sort of the normal thing? Or I've read that you could sometimes be tied up with ropes too. So is it a bit of a mixture? Or
there are many references to crucifixion nails. Mm-hmm. And this is in both Greek and Latin and rabbinic texts, where they could be used for magic and witchcraft and things like that. So it strikes me that probably implies that they were used, but then they were reused, and maybe they were reused for building or other things. But I mean, I don't know that they were all used for some sort of nefarious purpose like that. But I'm sure ropes were used, because I don't even know how. I mean, I don't understand physically how a nail through a wrist could hold the body in the air. I suppose, you know, physicists know that, you know, better than we theologians. But And one can imagine that if Jesus' wrists were tied with fetters, that perhaps his palms were nailed. For instance, and here I want to give two illustrations. There's a man in called the Arietti fresco. His arms are attached to a patibulum, to a horizontal. He's a prisoner. But he's standing on the ground, but his wrists are attached with fetters, metal fetters. And you can see that in the image that's, well, I've got one in my book, but you can just Google Arietti, the Arietti man.
You mean, and like a chain? When you say fetters, do you mean like a chain of some kind? Or how
like a, like a bracelet.
Oh, right.
Like a metal cuffs. Bracelet.
Yeah, like wrist cuffs. Yeah, yeah.
A cuff.
Yeah.
Like a large handcuff.
A handcuff, yes, yes.
And, yeah, something like that. Mm-hmm. A wide handcuff. And in the most ancient depiction of the most ancient gem in the British Museum called the Pereire gem of the crucified Jesus, it looks like these large handcuffs are around his wrists. So, you know, I don't think it was always nails. I think it could be ropes or other forms of attachment.
Well, all right. So along the lines of our gruesome questions, I mean, do we know how ultimately a person dies via crucifixion? I've heard all sorts of things. I mean, if you think that they're being nailed and pierced, like you would think they would die of loss of blood or something, but if they're tied up there, is it exposure? Is it something else? What kills somebody?
If you look at the medical literature on crucifixion, you're going to find a number of different theories. And I know two authors that wrote an article recently in a medical journal, and they counted opinions. And a lot of them went for asphyxiation. But, you know, for instance, it would depend on, was there a little seat? Because some of the ancient Christian authors talk about a sedile, a little seat, when they speak of the shape of the cross, by the way. That also is evidence for the shape of the cross. Authors like Justin and Irenaeus in the second century. But another question is, how bad was the flagellation and the torture beforehand? So how long would they have lasted? But there's a physician who's written a book that's sort of for the Catholic laity, and I suppose Protestant too. But he thinks it was hypovolemic shock. And but his research is very dependent on the Shroud of Turin. So, you know, I have very mixed feelings about the Shroud of Turin. And
What did you call it? Hypovolemic?
What's
hypovolemic shock?
I don't know. It's shock. Okay. But it's shock. But
as a result of, does he mean sort of like as a result of the trauma of the torture? Is that what he's saying?
Yes. The trauma of the whole entire process of crucifixion itself. But, you know, I mean, you can't go back and crucify someone. And it's just not, you know, it's impossible. Mm. So there's no way to really know. And, you know, I love the title of the blog, Biblical Time Machine, because, you know, there's no time machine that will take us back to...
There is now.
...to sort of, you know, examine the... examine the reasons for, you know, people dying. You know, pathologists can't go there. And all we have are these theories, frankly.
Well,
I'm a bit skeptical that one will ever know the medical reasons for the death.
Sure. But I guess a part of this, I mean, in the literature, in these accounts that have survived, does it sound like, I mean, was it something that took a long time? Like, was that part of the punishment, the knowledge that it was not going to be fast?
Yes. There's a famous story in Josephus where he heard that some of his friends had been crucified, I think three of his friends. And so he goes to Titus and he begs that they be taken down from their crosses. Mm. And Titus does, but two died, one survived. So it's not really clear how long they were up there, but apparently they could survive several days. In this monograph of mine, again, I discuss a 19th century purported crucifixion in China where the individual lasted several days. So it's I think that probably varied. how long one survived and how long, you know, dependent on how bad one had been tortured and on the particular position on the cross and all sorts of things. One of the things that's more horrific is that since you could not keep birds of prey off of your body, the crucified victim could not, that they were attacked by animals. And I don't know that that the birds of prey necessarily waited till the individuals were dead. You hear about these sort of putrefying bodies on crosses, and I'm sure the Romans eventually buried these people, but some bodies were just left up there, and I guess the line between life and death there is pretty thin.
Gruesome stuff. And would would there have been a set place where all of this is happening? You know, like a bit outside Rome, outside Jerusalem. I'm just kind of thinking, you know, medieval times, you had the gallows and a gallows hill, and everybody sort of knew where to go to see the latest hanging in that case. But would there have been sort of set places where you knew that if you wanted to go and see a crucifixion, this is where you went?
There are texts that describe putting, you know, famous bandits up on very public places where people can see them. And I guess, you know, in the New Testament, maybe this sort of Golgotha is one of those. It's not entirely clear to me, but it's outside the gates of Jerusalem, isn't it, the Golgotha? So it must have been a place where they carried out their executions. But the Roman texts do, for instance, this is not exactly what you're looking for, but in the Spartacus revolt, they crucified 6,000 of these rebellious slaves, and they crucified them on the Appian Way from Capua to Rome. So, you know, people would have walked that were on business, their daily business from Capua to Rome, would have seen these people on the side of the road. You know, there parts of that road are still there, of the cobblestone. So you can kind of envision yourself looking at 6,000 corpses, crucified corpses. Yes.
Well, that seems clearly to be, obviously that's the intent in part of crucifixion, right? This is a public execution that is meant to send a message. Is that clear from the ancient records that this was done to send a message to any would-be rebels and thieves and bandits?
They tried to send messages, but I don't think it worked any better then than it works now. You know, that's one of the last justifications for the American death penalty, or the United States death penalty, is that it has some value in
deterrence,
preventing people from committing the same crime. But I don't think it really works. Going back to the shape of the cross, I would like to say one other thing. Lucian says that the word Stauros is horrific. There's one of his dialogues. He's a well-known Greek writer of the second century. One of his dialogues says that the horrific word Stauros is so horrible because the letter tau is the letter of crucifixion. Now, the tau is the shape of a capital T. All of the early images of crosses are capital T's. They are not the later Latin cross, which I would call the small T. In other words, it looks like, and that includes the Pereire gem in the British Museum, that it's a capital T shape. So, you know, I don't know if you would call that a myth, that you have, you know, the sort of plus shape for crosses on all jewelry, but it does seem to be I don't know if that's really pure chance or pure coincidence. It strikes me that probably, well, I don't really want to base this on a few images and the text of Lucian, but I think probably that a lot of them were capital T's.
Mm. And that makes sense when you picture a horizontal piece and a vertical piece, because I was thinking to myself, well, how are you getting that horizontal piece onto the vertical piece? But if it just gets plopped on top, you know, if you're making that capital yes. T, that seems a lot
it's simpler. Easier.
It's stronger. I mean, isn't
you're
it?
Not making a you're not making a mortise and tenon joint, which is complicated woodworking.
Yeah.
Especially if you've got sort of a few thousand of them to do. You've got to get these things up out. Fast, yes. haven't you?
Wow.
One thing I read in one of your articles, at least I think I'm dredging it up now, but I've read quite a lot of your articles on crucifixion. And I seem to remember that you said in one of them that the people, there were sort of like set people. I mean, I suppose we're not talking about the soldiers who are doing this at time of war, but at other times there's a sort of a group of people who are responsible for crucifixion.
Professional crucifiers.
Yeah,
right?
Professional crucifiers. And they wore red stuff because of the blood. Is that right? Am I remembering right there?
In the same town of Puteoli, and I don't know if this is by chance, but in the same town of Puteoli, where the most ancient graffito of crucifixion was found, is a law on stone tablets was found. Now, it's now in Baia, nearby, an archaeological museum. But in that law, it talks about the workers, and it franchised out the right to crucify slaves and others, and people... in other words, it was private crucifixions and public crucifixions. And there were a set of workers who had to live outside the town. Hmm. And I believe they dressed in red, but they were the ones who were responsible for the executions. And it tells how much they were paid for four denarii, which is, you know, not a lot of money, but
per crucifixion?
I guess it was worth something.
Is that per crucifixion or per day?
Per crucifixion.
Right, wow.
And they were, but they were a class of people that are not really respected or something like that. Mm. I don't know. I'm searching for the right word. I don't want to, well, maybe untouchable is the word. But they lived outside of the town, and there were rules for when they could come into the town.
Even. Oh, wow.
The last image I have of crucifixion in my book was of one that was in Japan. And their method of crucifixion there was similar to the Romans, except that they used a spear to pierce the side. And you can see at the very edge of the picture, the men who carried out the execution, and they are sort of the lower class of Japan who people don't want to be around. But it's a, you know, it's curious that the Romans made beautiful pottery in which they put gladiatorial games and execution by animals, but they certainly included no crucifixions on those.
Yeah, do you think there's a reason for that? I mean, what's your theory? Why would they have not shown this?
Either they were too used to it, or it was too horrific even for them.
Hmm.
But apparently they enjoyed the arena very much, and it didn't bother them to have this African red slipware, it's called, very fine pottery. In which are depicted deaths by animals. So if you could imagine having fine china, and in that fine china, a person is depicted as hanging or something, I guess that was the form of execution.
They drew the line there
in the UK. But
yeah,
you know, it's just pretty horrific to even imagine, isn't it?
hanging, drawing, and quartering or something like that as you're having your tea.
Your gravy boat.
Yes. Your Earl Grey. Yes, it's pretty grim.
Yes.
Do we know
it
of
is
any,
grim.
Do we know of any other characters from the ancient world who were crucified? I mean, Jesus is sort of, you know, the big one, but was anybody else we might have heard of crucified?
Well, as I said, I have 18 names.
Oh, yes, yes.
18 names, and that's all. And most of those were not famous. So it's there are two Roman sources, that Roman historians use for famous people in the empire. One is the prosopography of the Roman Empire, it's in Latin, and the other one is the prosopography of the later Roman Empire. Now, these are names of people like senators and knights and, you know, very high-class people. But there is no prosopography. The Latin word for condemned is damnatorum. There's no prosopography of the condemned of the Roman Empire. In other words, people who were condemned to death. They just didn't bother keeping the names of those who were crucified and thrown to the wild animals. Well, there are some names, but of the crucifixion, I mean, I could only find 18, maybe one more, but of those 18, one or two are a little bit questionable. So very strange.
I guess that's part of the thing with crucifixion, though, isn't it? You're just snuffed out. You know, there's nothing, you're not remembered in any way. That's just you gone.
You're snuffed out, is right.
Well, I mean, you brought up that fascinating detail about the shape of the cross, you know, perhaps being this capital T. Clearly, that is not how, you know, Christianity has remembered and commemorated it with the crosses that are used today. But do we have an indication, or do we have like an evidence that says this was one of the earliest uses in Christianity of the cross symbol? Like, when did the cross as a symbol for Christianity start to emerge? Do we know?
Well, here there is a massive disagreement with one of my colleagues named Bruce Longenecker. He thinks he's found crosses in pre-Vesuvian Pompeii. Well, I guess that's the only Pompeii. I don't believe it. I don't believe it. I think the earliest that we know of is this Alexamenos Graffito from the 3rd century. And then after that, you have the gems and you have the Santa Sabina doors in Rome that are these beautiful wooden doors with a depiction of Christ's crucifixion and that of the bandits. And I believe that's 5th century.
Wow.
And if your listeners would like to see these images, they're all in Felicity Harley's articles on her Academia website. So she really has done wonderful work. Felicity Harley McGowan, wonderful work on these things. And she's the expert in Christian images of crucifixion. But they emerge in the 3rd century and they come. And it becomes a victorious symbol, actually.
Right. All right, John, we're trying something new, and you're going to be our first experiment. So good luck with this. But you mentioned earlier that, you know, if only we had a functioning time machine that we could go back and see and know some of these things. So I don't know. I don't know if you want to travel back in time and witness the crucifixion. That sounds like a rough afternoon. But, you know, if you had access to a time machine, and I should tell you that we do have access to a time machine, where would you go? When would you go? Is there something that you've always thought, man, if I could just see that in person, that would be amazing? So that's our question. What do you think?
It would be the days of Holy Week.
Uh-huh.
Including the Sunday morning.
You're getting a whole week here. Is that?
Yeah, it would be.
Or are we leaving?
Well,
you
it would be Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Right.
If I had the chance.
Right.
Why? Is it just so that you know what happened, or is it just that you want to experience
it? I my conviction is that if the resurrection is not true, the crucifixion of Jesus is probably just another meaningless execution of a bandit, an alleged bandit, or, you know, so that's, but of course one cannot watch resurrection either, but one can see the change from pain to joy if the, you know, if the gospel's witness is correct there. And of course Christians believe it is, but one can see the change from this sort of lost community to one in which they find joy. So, that would be visible, I think.
Wonderful. All right. Well, we'll get you a turn in the time machine. We should tell you it costs $2 million each time, but,
and it's hard checks, to use.
We take Venmo. It was a very expensive piece of technology. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you, John, so much for being here and talking to us about this fascinating, a little bit of a dark topic, but equally fascinating. And thanks, Helen. Thank you to our listeners. And this has been another episode of Biblical Time Machine. We will see you next time. Bye.
Bye.